So the sixth commandment, very simple, you shall not murder, it says. I saw it in a book, in a zoology book. Quote, every individual is absolutely unique, the first and last of its identical kind. End quote. Unique. The first and the last. Never anybody else just like me. Never, never. I am the only one just like me. I am a race by myself. When I die, the world will have lost me forever. Think of it. Spermatozoa and oogeny. Chromosomes and enzymes, protoplasm, cytoplasm, synapsis, mitosis, ontogeny, phylogeny. Think of it. The 100,000 billionth possibility produced me. The 100,000 billion. All the combinations and changes and chances that made me can never again come together exactly the same. I am a person of distinction. I am I. Well, Sir John Barton celebrates his human individuality in his poem, appropriately enough entitled, Egomania. It is an emotive argument he uses, don't you think? But in my view, it's one which is logically flawed. I mean, the fact is, our modern biochemical understanding of human reproduction, which inspires his poem there, it has, if anything, tended to diminish respect for the human individual, I think, rather than foster a heightened appreciation of his or her value. It's brought in its wake, in fact, a whole host of unprecedented ethical dilemmas in this area. Test tube babies, surrogate mothers, embryo research, gene therapy. In short, just about everything which Aldous Huxley predicted in his Brave New World. And as he anticipated in that novel, the effect of such scientific advances upon our culture is potentially dehumanizing, even demonic. Rationalized now in the reductionist, mechanical terms of molecular synthesis, the mystery of where a new human being comes from has been dispelled. A baby is no longer a divine gift. Increasingly, we're being educated to see it as an artifact of human technology. Unique individuals we may be, but only in the sense that a dice thrown at random has to come down on a single number. Well, if we can load the dice in some way and so control the outcome of the throw to our own advantage, why not? Or if we can predict the fall of the dice in advance and so abort throws which we calculate will terminate in less desirable numbers, once again, why not? We selectively breed plants and cattle. What's so special about a human being? That we must treat every individual as possessing some inviolable, intrinsic value. So we are unique. So what? No two snowflakes are identical either. But that doesn't make them particularly precious. I mean, the mere fact that every human being is a unique genotype, the product of an almost unrepeatable permutation of the DNA code, that doesn't mean we have the right to think of ourselves as possessing scarcity value. You ask any economist, he will tell you that whether an item is valuable or not depends not so much on its rarity as on whether anybody wants it. In what sense, then, is an unwanted baby valuable? Valuable to whom? That's the question. And it's a question John Barton will not find answered in his zoology book. But we're going to find it answered this morning in the Book of God. We've been speaking about the moral maze in recent weeks. the moral maze we have to tread in our late 20th century society. In my view, it is nowhere more tortuously convoluted than where it touches upon the issue of the value of human life. Confusion is rife in this area. I mean, on the one hand, a storm is raised in the media at the mere suggestion that the African elephant might be legally hunted once again. And yet, on the other hand, thousands of human fetuses perish weekly in hospital incinerators. There's scarcely a murmur of protest at this silent holocaust. If we're going to find our way through the labyrinth of distorted priorities which are involved in the subject, we need a map. And a map is what God has given to us. Oh, I'm not saying that every riddle raised by contemporary developments in embryology and genetics can be easily solved by simple reference to the Bible. Clearly it cannot. These problems are frequently so bizarre, so complex, so utterly original to our century, that they test the ablest student of biblical ethics. And it would be foolish to pretend otherwise. But without the Bible, our situation in this sea of moral uncertainty in which we find ourselves would be utterly hopeless. Even if it doesn't provide us with slick, ready-made answers to every choice that confronts us in this vexed area, the Bible does focus our mind on the key issue. And nowhere is that issue expressed more succinctly or with more imperative force than here in the sixth commandment. In the original Hebrew, just two emphatic words. That's all it is. In English, we require four. You shall not murder. To translate it, thou shalt not kill, as the old authorized version used to do, whilst legitimate, invites several unwarranted interpretations. This is not, for instance, a pacifist charter. The context of Old Testament history makes it quite clear that God was not intending to prohibit war by this instruction. There is a respected Christian tradition of pacifism, but you cannot defend it legitimately from this text. Similarly, it's not a proof text for vegetarianism. The Jews ate meat, and the sixth commandment never stopped them enjoying it. No, the verb which is used here in Deuteronomy 5 has reference to the private, violent slaying of a human being. And for that reason, the new versions, which render it, "You shall not murder," rather than "thou shalt not kill," are open to less misunderstanding. But having said that, it would be a mistake to interpret this word so narrowly as to conclude that it only has reference to the Dr. Crippins and the Jack the Rippers of the ancient world. Now, compressed in this synopsis of God's moral law that we call the Ten Commandments, no murder, in fact, enshrines a general ethical principle, which you can identify running throughout the length and breadth, not just of the law of Moses, but of the whole Bible, and which we may call, I think, this morning, the principle of the sanctity of life. It has ramifications in many more areas than just violent crime. See, if you ask the Bible, why are we not to murder? The answer we're given is not just murder is an antisocial act. Rather it is that by definition murder involves the destruction of a life. And life is precious. In some very special and unique sense, life is precious. It would not be going too far to say it is sacred. Let me point you to a passage in another part of Moses' law which highlights that a little. Leviticus chapter 17. Go back a couple of books from the book of Deuteronomy. And in the middle of Leviticus 17, you'll find some words I don't suppose many of you have studied with any great care in the past. Verses 10 and following of Leviticus 17. This is what we read. Any Israelite or any alien living among them who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from his people. For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Therefore I say to the Israelites, none of you may eat blood, nor may an alien living among you eat blood. Now this rather strange law is of course the foundation of the kosher food regulations that are observed by strict Jews even today. According to the law of Moses, blood had to be treated with reverence wherever it was seen. If you look at verses 13 and 14 that follow on from these verses, you'll see there's a requirement that any animal killed in the hunt has to be drained of its blood and the blood respectfully buried before the corpse is taken away. According to Deuteronomy 12, domestic animals slaughtered for meat had to be treated in a rather similar way. The reason cited in both cases is that the blood, in some unspecified way, represents the life of the creature involved. Now, if we're tempted to pour scorn on this as some kind of primitive superstition, then I think we need to remember that for all our modern knowledge of arterial circulation and hemoglobin, most of us still retain a certain squeamishness about blood that we find hard to explain. I mean, there's many a medical student that has been known to faint or vomit at their first experience in the operating theatre, and there are some of us who can hardly cut a finger without going a delicate shade of green, aren't there? The psychological roots of this taboo about blood are buried very deep in our racial memory. It's true, of course, that the life is in the blood is not satisfying to us as a physiological statement these days, but it's not intended as such. This is a perfectly accurate expression of an association of ideas, which is part of the common fund of our human culture and vocabulary. When we see a pool of blood on the road, it speaks to us of violent death. A life has been lost. There is the evidence of it. The life blood is spilled. So by teaching the Israelites to reverence blood, God was teaching them also to reverence life. There's another passage in the Old Testament that confirms the antiquity of this association of ideas, and in an interesting way establishes a clear link between them and the sixth commandment that we're looking at today. I'm speaking about Genesis 9 here, the very first book in the Bible, Genesis chapter 9. And here I'm looking at verses 4 and following. Genesis 9 verse 4 says once again, "But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each man too I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made man." So here then is the connection established in God's mind between the prohibition of eating blood on the one hand and the criminality of murder on the other. Both, we're told here, are rooted in this common doctrine of the sanctity of life. Life is God's gift, and he tells us we are accountable to him for any taking of it. Even animal life, he says, which is given to us for food, it is not to be taken in some careless or contemptuous fashion. The blood is to be treated with respect. It may very well be that this has relevance in the whole debate about blood sports and vivisection, in my view. And as for human life, man's blood is not to be shed at all, we're told, on penalty of death. For his life is not just a gift of God's grace. Human life is a reflection of God's person. In the image of God has God made man. All life, then, is sacred, and human life supremely so. And reverence for blood was a primary way in which this sanctity of life was inculcated into the Jewish mind in the Old Testament. Well, it's with that in mind that I want us to look at a couple of issues that derive from that doctrine of the sanctity of life, which I think are of relevance to us this morning. There are many things we could talk about if we had time in connection with you. We could talk about the way we regard murder in the media or the way we punish it in the courts. We could talk about Jesus' comment about the sixth commandment, how anger and verbal abuse amount to a breach of the sixth commandment. But we're showing the same contempt for another human being when we swear at them or abuse them or get angry with them or lose our temper with them as when we murder them, he says, and are just as guilty. But this morning I just want to focus on two issues. The first, which we've already introduced, the way we value life in the womb. And the second, the way we understand the cross in our Christian experience. First of all, the way we value life in the womb. You're having to use your Bibles a bit more than normal this morning. I'm sorry about that. Well, no, I'm not really. Psalm 139 are some verses I want you to look up here. The way we value life in the womb. Psalm 139, verse 13, this central paragraph of a very profound psalm, reads like this. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. As far as I'm aware, abortion is never really mentioned in the Bible. Sometimes reference is made to a text in Exodus 21, which lays down compensation for a pregnant woman injured in a brawl, resulting in the loss of a baby. But that's in the context of accidental injury. It doesn't have any relevance, I think, to the question of a deliberately procured abortion. Of course, there are some who are quick to seize on the silence of Scripture on this issue as an excuse for liberal attitudes. One does not know for certain whether God regards abortion as murder or not, they say, so why not do it? The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't. But frankly, that seems to me to be frivolous in the extreme. One writer says, in such a spirit, a rescue team might decide not to go out on a cold night, since there is at least an evens chance that the lost mountaineers are already dead. Now, if you are not sure whether somebody's life is at risk, the only responsible attitude you can take is to err on the side of caution, surely. To do otherwise, even if it's not to incur the charge of deliberate murder, is certainly to leave yourself open to the charge of manslaughter by negligence. But in any case, the Bible is not quite so silent about the status of the unborn child as is sometimes suggested. Look again at these verses in Psalm 139, for instance. The psalmist here quite clearly traces his identity back to his mother's womb. He does not seem to admit of any discontinuity in his personal history. He tells us he has been surrounded by God's providential care and purpose, no less prenatally as postnatally. And that being so, it is surely hazardous in the extreme to try to draw some arbitrary line across the path of fetal development and say, well, after this point, it's a human person in God's eyes whose life must be protected. But before that point, it's an organic blob in God's eyes which can be legitimately disposed of down the sink. It seems to me that anybody who views their own existence or the existence of any human being in the way the psalmist does here must find great difficulty in drawing such a line. Oliver O'Donovan, who's now Professor of Moral Philosophy at Oxford, gives an illustration, I think, that amply proves the inconsistency which medical practice is bound to get into when you try to define such a line legally. He says, let's suppose that a gynecologist is faced on the same day with two women, each pregnant at exactly that point in their pregnancy, up till which the law says they can be given a legal abortion. Let's suppose again, he says, that in one case, the mother is the victim of a fatal road accident. Her child is taken from her womb just before she dies and placed in an intensive care unit, where, against all the odds, this little premature infant survives and thrives. In the other case, he says, let's suppose that the mother is a depressive and seeks termination of her pregnancy because she really can't cope psychologically with the idea of another baby. So the requested abortion is performed and the fetus disposed of in the usual way. Now, says O'Donovan further, let's imagine that a few months later the gynecologist is invited to attend the christening of the child he saved. He hears its name given, Peter. And he reflects on the narrow escape that enabled Peter to enter life. Perhaps carelessly he finds himself saying, lucky fellow Peter, not to go the way of Paul. But at this he pulls himself up, telling himself that Peter wasn't Peter then, merely a potential life, and that Paul, as he has imaginatively christened the other fetus, was never a person at all. The father comes up and says, I'm so grateful to you for saving Peter. He feels he ought to reply, but I didn't save Peter, I didn't save anyone. But that's too absurd. Try as he will to deny it, Peter, who is now very much an infant personality, insists on thrusting his identity backwards into fetal life. It is Peter whom the gynecologist rescued. But if so, he asks himself, whom did I throw into the incinerator? I can't very well say that I rescued Peter and threw nobody into the incinerator. Either I rescued nobody, or I destroyed somebody. Now, the Bible is clear, it seems to me, that terrifying though it is to confess it, the latter is true. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb, said the son. Though he was completely unconscious of God's providential care at that time, though he admits he did not even look truly human in those early stages, yet that was me. And you, God, were looking after me and making plans for me. My history began when your creative handiwork began in me. And there's no way we can locate that moment any later, it seems. And the moment of conception. And don't misunderstand me, I would not personally want to defend the position that abortion is something no doctor could ever perform in any circumstance. Sometimes situations are very complex, and we do not have the luxury of a right solution. And with fear and trembling, we have to do things which our consciences may have difficulty with. Often, all we have is the awkward dilemma in the real world of deciding between a variety of lesser evils, rather than being able to do the thing that perhaps we feel completely at ease. That's, for instance, why Christian ethics has always accepted that where a continued pregnancy presents a major threat to a mother's life, a doctor may consider terminating the pregnancy. But I have to say to you, the vast majority of abortions that are being conducted today do not fall into the category of those lesser of two evil decisions. They're not performed because the mother's life is at risk. They're not even performed because there is some serious handicap threatening the life of the baby. They're not even cases of teenage rape, or any other of those awkward cases that are always cited in the debate, but which only represent a fraction of 1% of the actual cases in a hospital ward. The vast majority of abortions today are being performed for convenience. To speak of therapeutic abortion, when there is no serious threat to the health of either mother or child, is a most disgraceful abuse of vocabulary. And to speak of a woman's right to choose When the choice we're talking about involves the destruction of another human life, is a most appalling inversion of moral priority. All right, maybe it is unfair that women have to bear the burden of motherhood biologically. Maybe you do have an argument with God about why he has arranged things so unjustly. But does that mean the right to choose involves the right to get rid of a prenatal infant? I mean, supposing you're walking on a mountainside and you pick up a rope only to discover there's a climber hanging on the other end of it. And you are now holding him over the abyss. Does your right to choose mean that you can let go of the rope? Simply on the grounds that you did not seek to be in this embarrassing situation, and there are lots of other things you'd rather be doing right now? No one has to say that experimentation in the area of human embryos, too. For all the benefits that we may be able to foresee as a result of such research, lays itself open to serious criticism for precisely the same reasons as abortion on demand does. The 14-day limit recommended by the Warnock report is just another arbitrary line. Whilst it is undoubtedly less emotionally objectionable to dispose of fetal material, which is at such an early stage of development it doesn't look human, and cell differentiation hasn't begun yet, it's very difficult for me to defend intellectually the view that a fetus suddenly deserves protection when it's 15 days old in a way that it doesn't when it's 13 days old. Seems to me we are in grave danger today of playing out the role of Dr. Frankenstein, but under the microscope, rather than on the operating table. Of course, it's less gory and less obviously bizarre to do it under the microscope, but it is not obvious to me why it is less morally dubious. Some of the arguments I find being currently used in support of the Warnock proposals are in fact uncannily similar to those which were used by Dr. Joseph Mengele. You know who he was. He was the notorious scientist who led Adolf Hitler's program of eugenic research in Nazi Germany. Let's eliminate inferior types of human beings, he said. Let's purge the race of its imbeciles and its cripples. Let's propagate instead beauty and intelligence. It's very important for us to remember that Mengele was not alone in believing in the desirability of such eugenic research in the 1930s. There were eugenic societies in England and America, as well as in Germany. And there were leading intellectual figures in the early years of these centuries, of this century, numbered among the supporters of those societies. Sidney Webb, the founder of the London School of Economics, was prominent. The biologists Julian Huxley and J.B.S. Haldane. Mary Stopes, the pioneer advocate of birth control. George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor of the telephone. Even Theodore Roosevelt and Winston Churchill were supporters of eugenic research in their early years. In fact, it was not until the Third Reich demonstrated the contempt for human dignity, which is implicit in this dream of an artificially manufactured master race, that people at last woke up to the essential immorality of eugenic research. Yet now it seems, 50 years on, the intoxication of recent advances in the biochemistry of life are making us forget the lessons the Third Reich taught us in this regard. It is notable that alone in Europe, the West German legislature has decided to severely restrict in vitro fertilization of human embryos and the research that goes with it. I suspect that their memories of Dr. Mengele are rather more durable and vivid than ours. Well, one could go on from this question of the value of prenatal life to a discussion of other major contemporary issues of medical ethics, like, for instance, euthanasia. The two issues are not unconnected. For a society which can talk glibly of therapeutic abortion is likely to be a society which can also talk glibly of mercy killing. Just as in the case of abortion, it's important not to overstate the case in a way that's unfair to doctors. Switching off a respirator in the case of somebody who has been diagnosed brain dead is not euthanasia. Neither is withholding treatment from a very old or severely handicapped person. Perfectly appropriate that a doctor uses judgment in assessing the degree of medical intervention that is appropriate in any particular case in order to prolong the life of an individual. The old precept, thou shalt not kill, but needs not strive officiously to keep alive, is a perfectly tenable one. To suggest that a doctor is morally obliged to bring the full panoply of modern medical technology to bear on every case he or she encounters, irrespective of the age or condition of the patient, that's nonsensical. There are many cases, for instance, of terminal illness where it's far more appropriate to control pain than to administer radical surgery. Cases where a caring hospice is far more affirming of human dignity than an intensive care ward. But the principle of the sanctity of life means that no doctor has the moral right to intervene in such a way as to intend to cause death. That is murder. No other word will suffice. Human life belongs to God. No matter how compassionately motivated, no matter how old or how young the patient, human life belongs to God, and for that life blood, I will demand an accounting. Whether it be the life of the unborn child whose abortion we have legalized, or the life of the AIDS patient whose suicide we have aided and abetted. We simply dare not treat human life in a high-handed and contemptuous fashion. It is sacred. And we shall give account to God for every defiling breach of the sixth commandment, in which we are either directly or indirectly. But that very blood guiltiness, which I fear at the end of the 20th century to some extent adheres to every one of us by complicity, is the very reason we need to look at this other area of relevance this morning. Our understanding of the cross in Christian experience. Come back with me for just a few more moments to that passage in Leviticus 17 where we began. And look more carefully this time at verse 11. For the life of a creature is in the blood, and I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. Now, we said earlier that these verses were the foundation of the kosher food regulations which Jews observe. But there is more to it than that, isn't there? This verse tells us that this idea of the sanctity of life and the associated idea of the sacredness of blood, which is the symbol of life, this is also the key, we're told, of the Old Testament sacrificial system. I have given it, that is the blood, to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. See, when a Jew broke one of the Ten Commandments, he knew that even if the civil law didn't demand the death penalty of him, at the end of the day, God's judgment would do so. A sinner's life was forfeit. To break God's law was to incur his holy anger and was to invite his judicial condemnation. What could a faithful Jew do in such a situation? He knew he'd broken the law. What hope was there for him? The answer, according to the Old Testament, was sacrifice. A lamb without blemish or defect had to be offered at the altar. The Jew in question was not allowed to buy himself off the hook with money in any way. A life was forfeit, and therefore a life must be paid. The life of a creature is in the blood. I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. You see what God is saying there? When an Israelite sacrificed an animal at the altar, he was offering a substitute life to satisfy the demand of God's justice, the animal's life in exchange for his own. That's how he was being taught to understand the transaction. And the blood which was shed and sprinkled on the altar confirmed to his conscience and to the eye of God, if you like, that such a substitutionary death had indeed taken place. The penalty had been paid. The sin of that believing Jew was now covered, or to use the word the Old Testament often uses, it had been atoned for. And as a result, the life of the sinful human had been spared. Now hold that in your mind as I read to you some words from the New Testament. These come from the pen of the Apostle Peter in his first letter, chapter 1, verses 18 and 19, if you want to find them. Peter writes this to Christians. It was not with perishable things, such as silver or gold, that you were redeemed, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. I think it is possible sometimes to wallow in talk about the blood of the cross in a rather macabre way. Some of the older preachers and some of the older hymns do tend to do that. I must confess I've always had some difficulty engaging visually with the picture language of that hymn. For instance, there is a fountain filled with blood drawn from Emmanuel's veins. I don't know about you. But rightly understood, there is great preciousness in such words and in such pictures. The blood of Christ ought to be at the very center of our Christian experience. Why? Well, because as we pointed out at the beginning, we are, every one of us, squeamish about blood. And God is squeamish about sin. When a Jew saw the blood on the altar, it was a graphic illustration for him of how serious that sin was in God's eyes, how dire its penalty. He knew that there was no way he could get off with just a fine. Death was what the broken law of God demanded, and a death there had to be, if not his own death, then that of a substitute. But could the death of a lamb really be an adequate substitute for the forfeit life of a human being? Clear-thinking Jews always sensed it wasn't so. The animal sacrifices of the temple, they had to be pointers to something superior, something that satisfied the justice of God in a more rational and convincing way. The blood of bulls and goats can never really take away sins, comments one New Testament author. These rituals are just shadows, indicators of a better sacrifice that is yet to come. What sacrifice? You were not redeemed with silver and gold, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. So you see, when Christ died on the cross, he was offering himself to God as our substitute. Our lives were forfeit because we were sinners. We were under God's righteous judgment, and we could not buy ourselves out of that situation, even if we had all the silver and gold in the world at our disposal. No, life was forfeit. And a life, therefore, had to be paid. Christ's blood he shed on the cross, that is the symbol and the evidence of his substitutionary death on our behalf. We know as a result of our study this morning, don't we, the huge value which God places upon blood. Even the blood of sinful human beings. How much value do you think then God placed on the blood of Jesus? One who bore the divine image unmarred by any moral rebellion. The rebellion that defaces that image in us. The blood of his own dearly loved son. Yet God stood back, as it were, and watched us murder that precious life, shed its blood. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. I said at the beginning, it was pointless looking to zoology books, as John Barton's poem did, in order to find evidence for the innate value of a human being. According to modern genetics, we are the products of random chance, biochemical machinery, which when reduced to its elemental state, you could purchase for less than a fiver in any pharmacy. Now, if we are to have value, it's not enough that we should simply be unique individuals. If we are to have value, someone has got to want us. Someone has got to value our unique individuality and be willing to pay something for it. The tragedy of the murder victim, the tragedy of the aborted fetus, the tragedy of the discarded embryo is that nobody wants them. They are valued so little, they are treated so trivially, that they have been quite literally thrown away like junk. Not so. Somebody does want them. Somebody wants every human being that's ever existed. Somebody puts such value on our human life that they are even willing, prepared to give their own selves to preserve that life. That's why we're valuable. That's why we're valuable. That's why the sixth commandment says, "You shall not murder." For to murder is to despise that which is precious to God, a human life. And the message of the cross is this, that at the very heart of the universe, there is a loving God who wants us, values us, a God who is willing to pay any price to have us. Now, have you embraced that knowledge yet? I'm sure you know that Christians revere the cross and even put it on their walls and hang it round their necks. But have you understood the cross? Ironically, you see, that cruel, blood-stained instrument of judicial murder which stood 2,000 years ago on Calvary's Hill. Ironically, it is the most profound commentary on the sanctity of human life this world has ever seen. That cross says, God values even you. Let's pray together.